are you? Okay. So, if you wish, only if you wish, you ask where a good seat is. There is a good seat in back. No, it's empty. Okay, if you want
it's
to.
Okay.
Okay, you could sit wherever you like. Okay, good. Tov. So we're going to be talking about what happens to us during Sfiras HaOmer and what Sfiras HaOmer says to us. So that is, you look surprised. Do I have the wrong day? This is what we're talking about? Okay. Okay, so the word Sfira is related to the word Sipur, which means to tell a story. So the fact is our lives are full of stories, but we seldom really hear them because the components of a story are the presentation of the characters, the struggle, and the resolution. But for us, the characters are there, the struggles are certainly there, but as soon as there's a resolution, what is there? A new struggle, new characters. So the stories run into each other. So part of what Sfiras HaOmer is about is to isolate the story so we could see something, so we're not so close to the picture that we don't see the picture. So let's understand what Sfiras HaOmer is from two angles. From the angle of the halachot that present us with partial mourning, and from the angle of the mitzvah in the Torah that tells us to count Omer. And from there we'll go on to the story part. So starting from the mitzvah in the Torah, we're required to count Omer, as you know, from the second night of Pesach until Shavuot. So in terms of, and what are you counting for? So if you recall the way other people count, do countdowns in the December holidays, only 59 days till, only 49 days till, only, okay, got this? So they start with a large number, and they go all the way down till only one more day till, right? And we're doing the opposite. This is strange. Nobody counts time like this, do they? So the question is, what are we actually doing? So different commentators and sages have different approaches to this. The approach that you're most familiar with, probably, is that the offering that was done on Pesach was barley, which in earlier time was seen as animal food. And the offering that was done on Shavuot is the two breads. An animal will never make bread. So it's a transition from the animal state to the human state, and it has stages. So you're beginning with step number one, and then you end with step number 49, because each day is meant to take you higher onto this scale. And in that sense, counting in the way that we do makes sense. But the question would be, in what sense are we like animals at Pesach? And what makes us human about Sukkot, about Shavuot? So the idea is as follows. The Arizal gives this very interesting image. What was Pesach like? Imagine seeing a donkey give birth to a human. Is that strange? So Mitzrayim in Navi is compared to a donkey. Completely materialistic, no sense of exaltation, nothing. But through our being exposed to that, we became human. So the question is how? So there's a rule, which is you figure out who you are by first figuring out who you're not and what you don't want to be. So in a certain sense, the experience of being in Mitzrayim, which took us to the 49th level of Tuma, that's serious stuff, okay, brought us to a point where we knew this isn't who I am, this isn't who I want to be, and we were ready to be born. But then something interesting happened. Remember, I told you this is strange imagery. Imagine the baby is born and then forced back into the womb. Okay, so the Arizal says, so to speak, we were forced back into the womb in order that we birth ourselves. I want you to understand this. Not in order that we're born by force of the mother birthing us, but that we birth ourselves. So Maharal explains this phrase, to birth oneself. He says, Lamaisa, every day we give birth to ourselves. How so? If you were to look at your friend the elephant, you know, you have all sorts of friends. She gave birth. You went to visit her in the hospital. You want to see the baby. So you go into the infant room, We see all of these little baby elephants. They're so cute, only 1 or 2 tons. Okay. And there's the pink ribbons and the blue ribbons. Okay. Could you predict accurately what they're going to be when they grow up? Yes, they're going to be big elephants. What will they do? What every other elephant does. Right? Are there going to be any big surprises here? Nope, none of them are going to play flute. So, if you were to look at human babies in the infant room, could you predict who they'll be in 30 years? No. And the reason is that we birth ourselves. How do we birth ourselves? Through our choices. So basic rule in choice making is that the big choices are made on the basis of the small choices. Okay, so every choice we make has an effect, and the culminative effect is we become who we become at the end of the day. So an animal makes no choices, and therefore the sacrifice that was offered on Pesach, when we were birthed by the force of the miracles that Hashem presented us with, we were birthed, not we birthed ourselves, but we were birthed, that sacrifice is barley, it's animal food. We were in a state of animalism, meaning we're acting on instinct, not on choice. By the time we reach Shavuot, even though it says Kafala im Harke Gigit, that Hashem lifted upon us the mountain as though it was a tub full of who knows what, meaning the force of the miracles we had experienced was so enormous that how could we say no? There was still something in us that wanted, that said Naseh v'nishma, not only because of force. That's being human. So now we know what the transition is. Let's look at the halacha. The halachas of semi-mourning. In the light of what I just said, you would think the halacha should be that you start off in a state of exaltation and joy. You just got out of Egypt. And you get higher and higher and higher and higher until you're ready for Shavuos. So it shouldn't be a time of mourning. It should be a time of elation, lichora. But it's not. So the question is, why not? So many of us are familiar with the reason that's given in Shulchan Aruch, which is that it commemorates the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva. But the fact is the halachas were there beforehand. And it will also raise many questions. There's a lot of water under the bridge since the death of Rabbi Akiva's students. We don't have whole periods of mourning for the Inquisition, for the Holocaust, for the expulsion from Israel, for the 24,000 Kohanim who died defending the Beis HaMikdash at the end. What's so special about this? And why is there mourning? So we have to get into what this period is about. We said it's about choice making. So to make a choice real, there has to be concealment, not revelation. So this is a time of concealment. So when you count out the days, and we're going to learn the meaning of these spherot soon, chesed sheba chesed, gvura sheba chesed, it doesn't tell you, wow, this is chesed week. This is the week we're doing chesed will be so easy I have to grab on. No. This is the week where chesed is going to be very difficult. This is the week where you're going to have to choose chesed. And you go on to gvura. It's the same thing. So this is why this is the entire period is considered a time of concealment. A reflection of that. A reflection of the fact that there was so much concealment is that Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim died at that time. So you could ask, again, there's so much water under the bridge, why do we still even remember the death of Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim? So we have to take their deaths a step backwards. So by way of introduction, we have to talk about Gilgulim, which is also a theme on Shavuot because of the story of Ruth, Mahlon, and Kilian, and all of this. So the way Gilgul works is that everybody is different and individual, which we've all noticed. That's why when you look in the mirror, you're not surprised. It's you, not someone else. Wouldn't it be surprising to look in the mirror if it was someone else? Whatever. Frankie? What are you? Okay, whatever. Okay, so the reason why we look different is that we are different. And concerning this, the Gemara says, great is the king who mints thousands of coins and they're all different. We all have something different to accomplish. Let's say you don't successfully complete your task. What happens then? So you say, oy vey, But let's listen. There's a very famous, not so famous actually, but there's a statement in Tana Devei Eliyahu. So the Tana's walking down the road, and Eliyahu HaNavi appears. And Eliyahu says, "Have anything to ask me?" And the Tana says, "Yes." He says, "What?" So he says, "It says in Pirkei Avos, Ezuhu Ashir," what's the answer to that question? "Hasameach Bechelko." I want to thank you for no one saying, "Halo Meid Mikol Adam." Okay, but... he says, "I don't think anybody is Sameach Bechelko. What does this Mishnah really mean?" He says, to be Sameach Bechelko, that would mean if Aladdin's genie were to come forth from the lamp right now, they would go to you and say, "You have three wishes." If you're Sameach Bechelko, you would say, "I don't need three wishes. I don't need any wishes." Do we know anybody like that? If you do, wouldn't you think they're rather egocentric? No Geula Shlema, no Rufua, no, okay, whatever. Just I'm personally okay, no, whatever. So Eliyahu surprisingly says, "You're absolutely right. No humans are Sameach B'chalkam." So he says, "So what's this talking about?" So Eliyahu says, "Hashem." So the Tana is amazed. Hashem is Sameach B'chalko. He made perfect people in a perfect world, and look how we messed everything up. So he said, "But they're tzaddikim." What would you say? Rishayim. "But they're rishayim." And he says, "But the rishayim could do tshuva." What would you say? Or not. And he said, "And then, if not, they'll suffer their tikkunim in Gehenim. But in the end, yismach Hashem b'masav, Hashem will rejoice in his creations." Everything has a purpose. So, what does this have to do with us? Everyone has a task to fulfill, and if you don't fulfill it, in the end it'll be Yismach Hashem B'masav, there'll be tikkun. So there are many forms of tikkun. There are tikkunim in this world while you're still alive. There are tikkunim in Gehenim, which for some reason or other nobody ever invited me to speak about Sheva Medure Gehenim. Okay. I'm sure you want to hear all about, okay, whatever. And so it's another form of tikkun, which is Gilgul. So the way Gilgul works is, let's say you did 80% of your job, your soul will be sent back down to finish the other 20% because you need it and the world needs it. And the soul itself has many aspects. So you're familiar with this as nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida. So sometimes only one aspect of the soul requires rectification, and that's the aspect that will return. So this is why you'll have people who are, so to speak, fragments of a soul in this world. That's why when you meet someone, they may be a fragment of the same soul that you share. So that's why, "I think I know you from somewhere." "I don't think so. I'm from Nebraska." Okay, clear. So Hashem does this for us for the sake of rectification. Do you think the soul wants to come back here? No, not Amnon's piece or anything, but no, whatever. Okay, the soul doesn't want to come back here after experiencing the Kirva to Hashem in the other world, but we do come back. And the Arizal said already in his time that we're all here again. There are no new souls, he said. He's like, "Oy, okay." And that's why you learned French so easily in high school. You were the Count of Monte Cristo. No, whatever. So leaving this. Rabbi Akiva's students, the 24,000, okay? Any of you remember in Chumash the number 24,000 people coming up? And now we know why this year's winner of Tanakh was nobody in this room. So, Eliezer Friedman in Israel, you have no competition. Okay. So, you have the 24,000 people who were killed after the sin of Baal Peor. So we have to question the nature of that sin and understand what that has to do with Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim and what that has to do with us. Baal Peor was a very bizarre Avodah Zarah on the surface of things, whereby people worshipped their own body's waste. So this seems to be one of the things that when you read about, you could feel good, like, "I didn't do that." It's like out there with like offering your child to the Molech. "Nope, didn't do that recently, uh-uh." But if you don't clean your room, whatever. So What's it about? So I want to give you a rule that many psychologists maintain is absolute. When you have people get together and they want to form some feeling of union, what will join them most readily is coming to the lowest possible common denominator. Could you see where there's truth in this? So people enjoy saying, you know what, we're all just animals. There really isn't that much more. Okay, so this Avodah Zarah was a celebration of what? A celebration of everything that's debased, everything that puts you all the way down so that you could say, you know what, this is who we all are. Do you think people do this in different ways in today's world? Yeah. Okay, so this feeling of having to meet at the lowest possible common denominator comes from a person having no recognition of their own capacity to have a mission that's significant. Okay, so the tikkun would be to grasp human significance. So as you know, the reason for the death of Rabbi Akiva's students is attributed to the fact that what? They didn't give kavod to each other. Now make no mistake, they were on a very, very high level. They were Rabbi Akiva's talmidim. So we're not talking about them being rude to each other, throwing raw eggs at each other or tomatoes. We're talking about not being in the absolute sense appreciative of each other's kavod. What does this have to do with from Pesach till Shavuos? Being a human begins when you could appreciate your own inner kavod. There are 10 names for the soul. One of them is kavod. You're familiar with this from Tehillim. L'man yizamecha kavod v'lo yidom. Ura kavodi. So when you could see your own inner kavod, your own significance, you could move from being an animal to being a human. You could give birth to a human being. The ability to say yes to Torah is dependent on your believing that you could actually be a person of Torah. So you're familiar with the Gemara that tells us about how Hashem offered Torah to the nations, right? Yes? The right answer is yes. Yes? Okay. If not, next time I'll bring this ancient CD of Yom Tov Erlich. Okay, how many of you are old enough to know what I'm talking about? Wow. A famous Yiddish-speaking entertainer from the ancient world who had a song about Hashem offering the Torah to different nations. So, in any case, he offered it to the Edomites. What did they say? What does it say? What did Hashem say? Lo tirtzach. Now imagine taking murder and bloodshed out of Western civilization. No more cowboys and Indians. No more knights around the round table. No more British Empire upon which the sun never sets. What would you have left? Not much. So they said no. He offered it to the Ishmaelites. What did they say? What does it say? What did Hashem say? Lo tignov. And I want you to know, even today in their culture, they have a completely different attitude towards theft than we do. Everything for them is about winning. So in a theft, the victim is the stupid loser, and the thief is the victorious winner. You understand that? It's a very different attitude towards theft. My daughter once was volunteering in the hospital, and there was an Arab mother with a child in the same room. Her watch fell off her hand. Okay, the Arab woman bent down quickly to pick it up. My daughter was about to say thank you when the woman put it on her own hand. So she said, what are you doing? That's my watch. So she said, no, it's not. It's my watch. She said, no, it just fell off my hand. It's my watch. I said, it was never on your hand. I didn't know what you're talking about. So my daughter called the security guard. And he hears two different stories. Does he know who to believe? No. Would you take the watch from the Arab woman? No. In halacha, it's not even clear that he should. The one who has a claim has to bring the proof. So that's their approach. So when Hashem said, it says, lo tignov, they said, no, thank you. And to the B'nai Lot, he told them, lo tinaf. Now, I want you to hear this. As soon as they said, what does it say? It means two things. Do I want to do this? And can I do this? Is the bar too high? So if you were to ask the leaders of the Western world, is murder a good idea? What will they say? No. But that's too high a bar for them. You understand this? The bar is too high. You could only not ask any questions. The Jews had no questions. They didn't say, what does it say? If you believe whatever it is Hashem wants of you, you could do it. So this is called the recognition of Gadlut HaAdam, the greatness of a human being. Whatever Hashem thinks that I could do, I can do. The fact that he thinks I could do it is proof that I could do it. You have to believe in your capacity. So the story of who we are as human beings begins and leads towards our recognizing our divinity, recognizing what's powerful and enduring about who we are. So now what we're going to do is talk about the traits that are part of our story. So the word sphira, as I said, means story. It also means mispar, meaning what? Number. So when Hashem moved from his unknowable infinity to this world, he revealed himself in ways that are tangible and real. So in the Bereshis narrative, where it says, let there be this, let there be that, Hashem is saying, you could find me through this, you could find me through that. So the 10 statements of creation are 10 different ways through which Hashem tells his story, through the way he maintains and leads the world onto its destiny. So there are 10 spherot. Okay, now, you could say, wait a minute, we're talking about Amor. Aren't there like 7? Is she confused? No. Okay, so the 10 spherot are divisible into 2 segments. The way Hashem tells his story through his wisdom, and the way he tells his story through his traits. Hashem's wisdom is inaccessible to us. The first 3 sfirot, Chachma, Bina, Dat, we're not going to have it the way Hashem does. It says in Navi, Lo machshavotai machshavotecha, my thoughts are not your thoughts. I want to tell you why. Okay, here's how humans think. You see something, you say, hey, what's that? You try to understand it, well, what is it, okay? And then you draw a conclusion. Observation, understanding, conclusion. Everything hangs on observation. For Hashem, who created anything that could be observed, that's not his thought process. So the verb to think, using it the way we use it as humans, doesn't work with Hashem. His thoughts are not our thoughts. We can't think like he does. We don't try to go there. You have in Navi, Eov tried to go there. Did you ever learn Eov?
Yeah,
no. So you remember, what was the end of the story? Hashem says, and where were you when I created morning? Where were you when I created the innumerable grains of sand in the sea? How could you think that you're going to know my thoughts? So we begin with his traits. So each of his traits is implanted in us. So when you access these traits, what you're doing is mirroring Hashem. So you could ask, as they would in Neve sometimes, although presently we have girls who are very serious, but some of our girls, picture like a little while back, an 18-year-old chewing gum who leans over when she hears this, says, but what's in it for me? Okay. What's in it for me? So I want you to understand, what's in it to you for you to mirror Hashem? So to do that, I'm going to ask you to do a very easy exercise, an exercise that you will enjoy. You ready? Think of your favorite food. How many of you could do that? Yes? Okay, you're there with your favorite food? Like if you came home tonight and it was on the table, that would be just fine? Really well-made cheesecake, sizzling pizza, sushi. Okay, you're there? How many of you would say overcooked vegetables? No. Okay. Mouth watering quinoa. Okay, so I have to stop. Okay, whatever. So here you are with your favorite food. The pleasure is real, but it doesn't last long. Is that true? That's why we don't have food yard sites. So could you imagine that? Like, wow, it was 1972. I think it was October 23rd. This pizza was... No. Okay, let's light a candle. Okay, in current society, everybody knows this intellectually. Do you think people know this in their hearts? Nope. In the mind, yes. In the heart, no. So the people who are willing to admit that fact, because this is true not just of food, but of all physical pleasure, it's real, but it doesn't last too long, they move on to the pleasure of things that are beautiful. Owning a beautiful home, wearing gorgeous clothes, injecting Botox, okay, whatever. Shopping, music, art, dance, okay? Travel, nature, you're there? So that lasts longer. It touches a much deeper place. It touches a human place. Okay, animals don't have that. That's why you don't see animals this long. Okay, could you picture that? Okay, an old cat. Okay, so, but there's still a limitation, which people don't like to think about, which is you could own a beautiful outfit, but that doesn't mean that you are beautiful. And the same holds true to having a beautiful home, going to beautiful places. You could have beauty, but you don't necessarily become beautiful on any level. Okay, so most people in contemporary society don't want to go there. Okay, but the people who do, and again, intellectually everyone knows it, emotionally is the issue, they make their main efforts towards attaining pleasure, which is what all of our choices are trying, we're trying to get there through our choices, to the pleasure of relationship. So when you think of the person who you like the best, think of the person who you like the best. I'm not going to ask you who. You there? I realize that this is Queens, so there, it's possible in Manhattan. I would say, think of the person you dislike the least. Okay. In any case, there's you can't think of anyone, no, whatever. So when you ask yourself, why do I like this person? What do I like about this person? The usual answers that I hear are this person is sensitive, kind, accepting, brilliant, moral, what are some other ones? Funny. Okay, did I cover most of yours? Are any of these traits physical? Could you weigh them? Could you measure them? No. So when you're asking what you love about the person who you like the best, is it their soul or their body? What's the truth? It's the soul. Okay, now, if when you're with this person, you feel the way you describe them to yourself as being, you feel kind and sensitive and responsible and witty and brilliant, do you like them even better? Yeah. Sure, that's called spiritual bonding, which is the highest pleasure that we have in this world. The soul is an aspect of Hashem. What you love in the other person is the godliness in them. What you love in yourself when that comes forth is the godliness within you. So by mirroring Hashem's traits, you're getting in touch with the possibility of the highest forms of spiritual bonding. So with that, we're going to go into what these traits are. The way we're going to approach this is by talking about what the trait is, who epitomizes that trait, and what we should do with it. But I want to ask you a question first. How many of you read Hebrew well enough to learn a sefer that's not too hard? I strongly recommend a sefer to you. There's a sefer called Usfartem Lachem by Rav Frisch. Okay, it comes in two versions. The version he wrote, which is big, very heavy, full of Kabbalistic allusions. Not that one. And then you have the abbreviated version. Get the abbreviated version. Anybody can understand it. It's very inexpensive and it could be very transformational. Okay, so let's start with chesed. So he begins by saying, and what is chesed? So, quoting the pasuk, Lecha Hashem ha-gdulav, ha-gvurah, tiferet, etc., he says, gdulah is chesed, which means being big enough to say, I want to be mashpia tov on others. That's what chesed is. So chesed begins with your feeling you have something to give. So in psychological language, people talk today about the mentality of abundance and the mentality of lack. When a person feels that they have what they have abundantly, it's natural for them to want to give. When they feel lack, they'll be afraid to give. So Hashem, of course, gives continually. Everything you ever observe is from Hashem. A person who's in touch with the part of themselves that, yes, says, I have good that I could give. I have good in me that I could give, is going to want to give and will give. So this goes far beyond being nice. Being nice, which is what people sometimes think chesed is, could be included in chesed, but chesed is much bigger than being nice. So an example of chesed, I have something to give, would be looking for opportunities to benefit people. So I'll give you an example of this. In Givat Shaul, right next to Har Nof, there is a man, Yerushalma, older. He goes to every simcha in the neighborhood. Whether he's invited or not is not really is not really on the page. So he goes to the simcha, could be a wedding, bar mitzvah, whatever it is. Okay, mazel tov, mazel tov. Then he starts taking the candies out of his pockets. How do people look when he leaves? There's smiles on their faces. You could see this. So he does this because he has what to give. And I don't mean just the candies. What is he giving? He's giving himself. You understand this? So the will to give yourself and to give it generously is what chesed is. So therefore, chesed isn't only between a person and one's fellow man. It says in the Gemara, Ezu chasid, hamit chasedim kono. Someone who wants to do good to Hashem, I want to give you. You give me so much, I want to give you back. So that means I want to do some mitzvah perfectly. I want to bring glory to you on purpose. Okay, this is what chesed is. So there's a famous story in the Gemara, okay, that I'm going to parallel to an act of chesed that was done contemporarily. I think it was this past year, but of course I tend to freeze things in time. It might have been 35 years ago. There was a young man, who bought a piece of furniture secondhand, but he couldn't get it through the door. You know the story I'm talking about. So he took it apart. It was last year? Good. Okay, well, what did he find? A great deal of money. He went to the trouble of finding the owner. It was a great Kiddush Hashem. Now, I want to tell you something you may know or you may not know. Was he mechuyev to give back this money?
No.
No. He didn't have to give back the money. He could have taken all of the money and said, you know what? I bought the desk, the drawers and the desk. And the owner is more likely than not to be a fellow Jew who I would have to extend myself still further. I could just as easily say, here's my lucky day. Right this morning I said, Barech Alein was asking for Parnassa. Thank you, Hashem. Okay. He could have done that and he would have been okay. Okay, here's the story in the Gemara. There was a poor Tana. And notice how many there... Have you noticed in the Gemara a lot of stories about poor Tanayim and Amorayim? And they always seem to be going somewhere like they were on the Derech, you know, whatever. Okay, when do you hear stories about rich Tanayim and Amorayim who are like sitting back in their easy chair or whatever? So his students wanted to help him with Parnassa, so they bought him a donkey. And they bought him a donkey with all of the things that one needs to get a donkey working, a bridle, a saddle, the works. So after they deliver the donkey, he examines it, and he discovered precious stones in the bridle. So he said, who'd you buy it from? We have to return the stones. So the student said, and this is the part I want you to hear, you taught us the halacha, Rebbe. You taught us, not somebody else, not your Baal Plugta. You taught us that when you buy a donkey with its accompaniments, then the accompaniments are yours and everything that's in it is yours. Who taught us that? So he said, I didn't ask you who taught it. I asked you who's the donkey's owner. He was very insistent on giving it back. So he gave it back, even though he was the one who taught that you don't have to. And what did the donkey's owner, who was a non-Jew, say? He said, Baruch Elokad Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. And for him, for Rabbi Chanina, he said, for this, it's worth my coming down here to live. You understand? That's chesed. I want to give of myself. I want to give good. I want to do Kiddush Hashem. I want people to enjoy. Okay. When Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach would take taxis to places, so the drivers would sometimes ask, "Do you mind if I smoke?" And he said, "No, it makes me happy to see you smoke. You're enjoying yourself." Okay, clear? He would listen to this awful Mizrahi music. Okay, until at some point it was so unbearable that he actually gave the driver, who he took a CD of, I don't remember, I think it was Avram Fried. Okay, you know, your music is like so nice, I'm sure you like this too, you know, like whatever. But he would never say a word against listening to Ulm al-Fam or whoever he was listening to. Okay, clear? That's chesed. So chesed is the parent of all of the middos. And that's why it's number one. The second middah is gvura. It says, Lecha Hashem hagdula v'hagvura. What gvura? So he explains the ability to overcome any obstacle and to do battle with any rasha to bring forth good. So notice this. Gvura isn't fighting any battle so that you could win. It's fighting any battle so you could bring forth good. So let's picture this scenario a moment. You can't even take out the garbage? Okay, which by the way in Israel doesn't happen so much. In Israel, the culture isn't that the husband has to take out the garbage. Are you ready? Hold on to your seats. Whoever is leaving takes out the garbage. Like, you don't have to leave it in the house so that some... Okay, whatever. So, you know. But in any case, so could you picture somebody feeling that that's the big fight, that's the good fight, that's the noble fight for today? I'm not going to be a shmata. I'm going to... Okay, got this? That's not gvura. That's ego. Okay, clear? So it's not, you do it because I said so. It's not, I can show you, I'm strong enough to show you. It's not my way or the highway. It's, I will fight any battle, even my ego, any battle to get, to be able to bring forth good. So Avram epitomized chesed. Okay, which is easy to picture. We know his hospitality narrative. Yitzchak epitomizes gvura. He was willing to fight the ultimate battle. What's that? Against self. So when Avram was called upon to slaughter him, he thought, it's never called the Nisayon of Yitzchak. It's called what? The Nisayon of Avram. Because for Yitzchak, it was easy. What else am I alive for? Okay. And remember, he loved living more than we do. Next. The next one is Tiferet. Tiferet means harmony. So in all areas where we talk about harmony, like music, for instance, it's contrast. So in musical language, you call it point and counterpoint. Nobody would buy a CD that just has one note. Can you imagine? Okay. It's the contrast of different notes and different tones that makes music beautiful. The same thing would hold for art. Nobody wants to buy a picture that's just yellow. Although, I have to tell you, I was in a modern art museum where I saw a picture of blue. And I said, okay, you know, I'm not so cultured. So I accepted this. Say, maybe this is what more sophisticated people think is beautiful. I'll just accept it. Okay. Then I was in the waiting room of Hadassah, and I saw, you know, modern art hanging on the wall, which I don't understand or appreciate, and I thought I saw blue again. So I feel, oh, this is a copy of blue. Okay. Then the cleaning woman came. She turned all of the pictures to the other side because she couldn't figure out which side was right. So she left some of them and did the whatever. But what makes most people enjoy art would be contrast. Okay. So the way this works in life is as follows. There are people who, because they want to like life, will say all life is good. Everybody is good. I'm good. You're good. The weather's good. Everything is good. And if I see anything that's not good, I'll sweep it under the carpet and act like it's what? Also good. Are there people like this?
Yeah.
Is this necessarily constructive?
No.
No. And then you have the other extreme. Everything is bad. Mm-hmm. Everyone is bad. Scratch a tzaddik, you'll find a Russia. Okay? Okay, I even saw on that blog. Oh, God. Okay, whatever. I'm bad. You're bad. The weather's bad. Everything is bad. The truth is that Hashem created a world in which there are both, where there's both concealment and revelation. Yotzer or uvorei choshech. Hashem created both. In order for you to live with this harmoniously, you have to learn to rebrand them. The name of darkness is challenge. The name of goodness is inspiration. So you have to be able to see both at the same time. And not be afraid of it. So when you do that, everything in life could be beautiful. So Yaakov Avinu is the one who epitomized this trait. How? He had 12 sons. They were each born in a different month. Yeah, I know it's hard to remember. Like, which Dan was, what was it? Elul knows. Okay, whatever. Okay. The reason why they were born in different months wasn't coincidental. Everybody has mazel. Okay. Thank you for not saying, but it says Ein Mazal Yisrael. I appreciate that. Okay, what's Mazal? The word Mazal comes from the verb Lahazil, which means to drip down. So if you go to Israel and somebody says Yesh Lach Nezila, don't say Mir Tashem Bayu. It means something's leaking. Okay, so Hashem draws down to you whatever it is in life that you need. So different people need different things to fulfill their destiny. Yaakov was appreciative of this. So what he saw was that each of the 12 sons, who were born under different months and have different mazel and different potentials, each one of them a part of the whole of Am Yisrael. Now that doesn't mean he thinks they're all equally talented or equally intelligent or equally capable, but they're all equally part of the whole. So people have a mistake when they interpret the whole concept of shalom. In the UN, where of course they're great experts in making peace, okay, shalom is non-aggression, which is, that's, it's dead, it's passive. Shalom is dynamic. It's a process in which you help every person you encounter, every situation you encounter, every aspect of yourself, enter the right place to form the whole. So there's a halacha that you're not supposed to greet somebody with the name Shalom in the bathhouse because it's one of Hashem's names. Hashem created a world that's Shalem. The challenges, the inspiration are part of the Shlemus of the world. Using something with respect and saying it has a place is what true harmony is about. So that means that when Yaakov blessed Yehuda with Malchus, he didn't think that somebody else was capable of Malchus. But he thought somebody else was capable of what? Something else. And that all of these traits have value. Not necessarily equally. I want to make that clear. Not necessarily equally. Okay, next. These attributes, Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, which parallel the Avos, are the source of everything. The next four are offshoots. What's Netzach? Netzach is being willing to fight as hard as you have to fight till you win the battle for good. So it's an offshoot of Chesed. The direction is good. The person who epitomized that is Moshe. After the Chet HaEgel, he was willing to daven for us for 40 days till Hashem forgave us. And there's more. You can compare the response of different tzaddikim to similar situations. When Avram was told by Hashem that Hashem is going to destroy Sodom and Amorah, he did not see the justice of it. But he argued. And when the resolution was against him, he said, Anochi Afarfa Ephraim, I'm too small for this. I'm dust, I'm ashes. But he tried. Conversely, when Hashem told Noah there's going to be a flood, What did he do? It was basically, how many amos did you say? Okay. But when Hashem told Moshe that he was going to destroy the Jews, Moshe said, if you're going to do that, Macheni na misifrecha asher katafta, erase me. He was willing to be Moser Nefesh for this. That's Netzach. So it means not only believing in good, not only trying to do good, but willing to sacrifice yourself for the good of others. You know, you read stories about the Gedolei Torah sometimes. Everyone is familiar with the story about Reb Moshe, how the woman would call him every Erev Shabbos to ask what time Hadlakas Neiros are. You know the story, right? Now you do. Okay. And he would patiently answer, 6:15. Okay. So after he was Nifter, she called again. And one of his sons answered and said, in a nice way, you know, there are calendars that tell you what time Shabbos is. And she said, really? She really didn't know. She never, like, she saw only non-Jewish calendars. She didn't know that there were Jewish calendars that tell you Hadlakas Neiros. So you could ask, and why didn't Reb Moshe just have somebody send her an MTJ calendar? And the answer is, he wanted to give her kavod. So this is Mesiras Nefesh, because his time was worth something. He was giving something that was irreplaceable, which is a few minutes of his time every week. That's Netzach. Then you have Hod. Hod is an offshoot of Grura. The person who epitomizes Hod is Aaron. So, are any of you the daughters of Kohanim? Okay, so it may be too late. I hope I'm not ruining your lives by saying this. But it says in the Gemara that a Bas Kohen shouldn't marry an Am Haaretz. Why not? Not because there's something wrong with the Am Haaretz, because Kohanim are not patient. She'll be after him the whole time. You can't even go to the daf? You know what I mean? Like, so that's, you know, so who needs that? It's like everybody's nightmare wife. So, okay, if you didn't understand it the first time, listen on Kol HaLashon. Want me to turn it on in the bedroom? Okay, whatever. So, on one hand, Kohanim were impatient. On the other hand, we know that Aaron was Ohev Shalom and Rodev Shalom. So how does that work? So the way it works is if you believe in someone, you're not going to let go. You're going to be after them until they get there. So Maharal explains the most patronizing thing you could say to another person is what, you know? For you, it's okay. You know, like, you're on a different madrega. Everybody has to do according to where they're holding. Okay, maybe one day, Be'ezras Hashem, you have to go step by step. Nothing could be more patronizing than that. Could you see where that's true? Okay, so Aaron was incapable of that. So this is why, you know how we solved quarrels, right? He would go to one person and say the person who he's quarreling with wants to make peace but is embarrassed. Quickly go to the other person and say the same. So when they would meet, each one thought the other was going to make peace and the quarrel would be over. You're familiar with this. Have any of you tried it? How many of you tried it? I want to know. Did it work? For you it worked. Anybody else? I tried it. For me it didn't work. And I figured I'll try it again. Every time I get the same result. This quarrel continues, but now there is something that unifies them. They're angry at me. Who asked you? Like, whatever. So I was trying to figure out, like, how come it worked for Aaron and it doesn't work for me? And I heard a story about Reb Arya that made me understand it. So, as you probably know, he lived in Nachlaot, which in his time was not cool. And, I bought Shavir Chesed. No, it was a different reality. And he was coming home. He walked through the shuk. And there was a robbery taking place. So he saw somebody, a thief, break into an electronic goods store. And he was taking out electronics, you know, mixers, televisions. He walked through the broken glass of the show window. And he went over to the thief. He looked him in the eye and says, but you know it says don't steal. And he meant it with his whole heart that this person he believed was capable of not stealing. And what happened was the man put down what he had in his hands and walked out of the store. If that would have been me, I'm going to show the thief that he really, okay, whatever. You would read it the next day in the paper. Woman killed in Machane Yehuda. Okay. So, you know, that's Aaron. Okay. The next trait. Now, Netzach and Hod, by the way, these, as you'll see if you ever see the book, so Chesed is the right hand, the stronger of the hands. Gvura is the left hand, right? Okay. Tiferet's the heart. Okay. Netzach and Hod, the two legs. You want to go anywhere, you have to be willing to get there. If you want to go somewhere, you have to have Netzach. You have to be willing to get there. If you want to have a goal, you have to believe in it. That's Hod. Okay. Next, Yesod. Yesod means foundation. Why do you need a foundation to hold up a building? Don't say because otherwise it'll fall. What's the reason you need a foundation? You're validating my son's stereotype about women. Do you know this? You can ask a whole crowd of women, but none of them know how. Okay. It's because the stability of the ground will hold up the mobility of the components with which you're building. Okay. But we understand people. Okay, whatever. Okay, so Yesod is the foundation. It says, Tzadik Yesod Olam. Of all of the tzaddikim, who's the only one who's consistently referred to as HaTzadik? Yosef. What was Yosef's Yesod? His Yesod is absolute devotion. The foundation of everything is absolute devotion. So Yesod is compared to a funnel, where Chesed, Gvura, Tiferet, Netzach, Chod, they all have to have a solid foundation. And the foundation is devotion. Whatever you want of me, Hashem, I'm devoted to you. I'm not going to betray you. So, a part of Yosef's story that not everybody knows, because you learn Yosef's story when you're a child, is during the seduction narrative, at some point he really desired Potiphar's wife. Did you know that? It was only because he was able to conjure up his father's image, Yaakov's image, that he withheld himself and didn't take her. What's the 10th commandment? What's the 10th commandment? Lo tachmod. Lo tachmod what? What does it say in the Torah? Eish es re'acha. He thought he transgressed. And he thought that he was doomed. He thought that he destroyed the purpose for which he was created, and that he's going to go to Gehenna. Now, could you picture a person who really thinks this, saying, look, I'm going to go to hell anyway, and I really want her, so I may as well take her. Just like kids today, oftentimes, when they see that they're not perfect, when they see that they're not doing well, they'll say, I may as well do what I want. Okay, so what did Yosef say? Even in Gehenna, I'm loyal to Hashem. No matter where I am, I'm loyal to Hashem. And concerning this, it says, Shevi yipol tzadik v'kam. A tzadik falls 7 times and rises. Meaning the fact that he falls isn't a reason not to rise. Okay, the last of the traits is malchut, which means kingship. So kingship means admitting to yourself that you're the ruler of you. So in contemporary society, and I see this even in the firm periodicals, this is a recurrent theme, the ikker is to find someone to blame. Okay, they don't call it blaming. What's the word that they use in place of blaming? Coming to terms with the event that caused you to be who you are today. The trauma, the mistreatment, the rejection. So it's all because of, then fill in the blanks. Your mother, your father, your husband, name any of the other 7 krovim for whom you sit shiva. Okay, got this? It's because of your family. It's because of your schooling. It's because of the society. It's because of the internet. It's because, what are some other because ofs?
Media.
The media. Okay. Because you're innocent. If left to your own devices, you would be what?
Perfect.
Okay. So most of the time there's truth in these deflections. It does have something to do with your mother, your father, your sister. It did. And don't pretend that in a world with media you're as innocent as in a world without. It's all true. But you know what? Somewhere along the line you have to say, so what? I'm standing here. The one who I have to deal with is who? Me. It doesn't matter whose fault it is that I'm me. The one who I have to deal with is me. I'm the only one I have. So that's called malchut. When you finally say, whoever I am and whatever reasons brought me here, I have to take responsibility. And then there's step two. And who do I want to be? So the idealized answer is somebody who puts the crown off their own head and puts it on Hashem's head. Meaning, Hashem, who am I? I'm whoever you want me to be. Where will I go? Wherever you want me to go. What role do I have? Whatever role you give me. That fluidity is the hallmark of Malchut. So you begin with Chesed, you end in Malchut. So when you make anything, I don't know if any of you are creative, if you paint, if you do pottery, if you sew, whatever it is that's creative, you have in mind when you start what the end will look like. Is that not so? Okay, Malchut is the end product. Malchut is the full act of humanization. Malchut is what gets you ready for Matan Torah. Malchut was the mitzvah of David, whose yahrzeit is Shavuos. Okay, his ancestor Ruth's Megillah is read on Shavuos. So when people hear David, like they think his last name is Hamelech, but I want you to realize, when you look at his life, he had every excuse you could possibly think of. He was rejected by his family and ostracized by them. He slew Goliath, as you know, and Shaul had promised his daughter, but the first daughter didn't want him, right? Okay, he married the second one. Okay, Shaul, who was so grateful to him, turned against him, as did all of his best friends. Okay, his immediate family were killed by the Ziphim. Okay, his wife was taken away by her father. Okay, what else could possibly happen to a person before they say, I've had enough? So when you read Tehillim, you don't ever see David falling into the trap of everything's just fine, do you? It's not, today's just great and tomorrow will be better because yesterday was, okay, whatever. No, it's Hatzilenina. Okay. Where's my soul? Avivi miyazavuni, Hashem yasfeni. But it always ends with what? But I trust you, but I love you, but save me. No matter where he was in life, he would say, but I want to serve you, Hashem. That's Malchut. So to accept Torah, you need Malchut, because Malchut is what enables you to say Nasa v'nishma, not what does it say. Okay, so that's what I'm concluding with. And I usually threaten to conclude at least twice before I actually end. Okay, but this time this is what I'm ending with. Don't move for a second. I want to bring my what? Tzedakah envelopes. Okay, so let me just get them. It'll take a second. It's right outside. And I'll tell you what they're for in a second. And then I'll hear questions if you have. Thank you. Okay, so I'll tell you what they are. Yes? What? A story component. Yes. Okay, I will go to the story component in a second. Okay, let me just explain the tzedakah envelopes. As you hear the story, I'll pass them around. Okay, so one of them is Hachnasas Kala. It's not Neve's Hachnasas Kala, because until today, you ready? We had a period where there was no Kala in Neve. Well, isn't that distressing? But today, literally today, Esther Mizrahi is engaged, okay? Okay, so this isn't for her, it's for a different some of you know her. Okay, she's from South America. Okay, and the other is for the call my family started. Those of you who are interested in becoming part of the Yisachar Zevulun agreements to someone learning Mishneh Berurah, you could read the literature. Want to pass this? Okay, so these are the tzedakah envelopes. Now the story component. So as I said, Sphira is a story. So the story is meant to be how you merge from a person. We all start as babies, very self-absorbed, very egocentric, very desire-oriented. And it's through these traits that our stories could make us more godlike and mirror Hashem so that we have real relationship and spiritual bonding. So if you want to know what does that look like, what does it look like when you see somebody actually emerge? Okay, so everybody has stories about their own emergence. So I'm going to just tell you one story tonight. It's a relatively short story, but press my buttons, I intend to tell more. Okay, Maisa Shahaya with Reb Aryeh. So he appointed himself, people don't always realize this, it isn't like there was a job called chaplain of the prisons and he applied and got the job, no. He started visiting prisoners because he started visiting prisoners. Why did he start visiting prisoners? Because he believed in the inherent kavod in every person, and he wanted to bring that forth. So, when he began his career, the prisoners who he visited were the usual people who you find in prison. People have very romanticized pictures of what prison is like they're all really innocent. No, they're not. They all really regret what they did. No, they don't. Okay, but some do, some don't. So the prisoners who we began with were thieves, murderers, rapists, the works. Okay, then, in the 30s, when you have the movement to get the British out of Israel, so the prisoners were political prisoners, and they were idealists. It was a whole different congregation. So during this period, one of the old kind of prisoners was arrested. A man had a fight with his wife, Erev Yom Kippur, okay, and killed her. Now, at this point, the other prisoners in the prison were chashuva young men. They were off the derech. They had sold their innocence out to secular Zionism because they didn't know the end of that trail. But they were idealistic and they were chashuv. And they were completely, completely repelled by this murder. So they excluded him. They wouldn't speak to him. Now, he had a life sentence. So imagine what it's like to be in a prison when you have a life sentence and the other prisoners walk out of the room if you walk in. Imagine what that's like. So he became depressed. So when he became depressed, past a certain point, he stopped eating. So the British were concerned, not because of their love of Jews, but because it looks bad if a prisoner dies of starvation if you're in charge of the prison. So the warden of the prison summoned Reb Aryeh, and he said, you're a man of the cloth, try to console him through your religion, okay? Because in their religion, the priest could actually forgive someone. So in any case, he spoke to the Mukhtar of the prison. The Mukhtar comes from the word Keter. It's an Arab word. It means the head. The head of the prison of the Jewish prisoners was somebody who later was in the Israeli government. He said, "What are you doing to this guy?" And he said, "He's the lowest of the low." So he went to see him. So he sat down next to the prisoner. The prisoner didn't want to talk to him. And I want you to hear what he said. But before I tell you what he said, what do you think he would say to this person who he wanted to sort of bring back to life? What do you think he would say? Be him for a minute. What would you say?
Maybe I'm sure you regret what you did. Maybe you regret it. I thought about it.
Maybe you regret, yeah.
I were to guess, though, that I did read a book on that. I would guess that he would sit down and say, I am so sorry for the terrible things that I did, because I'm just human and I know Hashem will forgive me. Mm-hmm. So that he should hear.
So I want to tell you what he said. I could picture saying something like that. Or, you know, do Chuvin will. He said, you did a terrible thing. That's what he said. You did a terrible thing. And he repeated to him what he did. And he said, and therefore, what Hashem did for you was a great chesed. He had you sentenced to prison. Because the way you are now, you can't live a life amongst people. Look what you did. But in prison, you could transform yourself. You could choose who you're going to be. You have the solitude. You don't have to work. You don't have to engage with other people. You could become whoever you want. And then the man began to talk. And he was consoled. So I had this story in my head for a long time. And the reason why I kept this story in my head is it's a spherous story. It's telling you how in the midst of the very worst, and this crime is the very worst, you don't escape from it by saying it's not there. Everything is just fine. You escape by it by confronting it and deciding, I want my story to be different. I want to appeal to Hashem's mercy. So I'm going to tell you a different story from Tanakh, which you probably know. Actually, maybe you do, maybe you don't. Okay, how many of you remember? Okay, you remember? Shoftim? Okay. So if you go back to Shoftim, you remember a story that goes as follows. One of the Shoftim, okay, lived at a time where the Midyanim were the enemies. And what they would do, it says, is that they would dig holes and make tunnels and pop up in the middle of people's fields. Starting to sound familiar? Who's our hero? I'm going to wait till you remember, okay? So he was in the field. He was there because he wanted to save his father from the danger of taking in the wheat when a tunnel could open up at any moment. So he brought the wheat, and his father said, you should say Hallel. And he was upset. The rest is Midrash. He says, where's Hashem? Is Hashem saving us? Where is he? Where is Hashem? And his father said, Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. So he said, so why doesn't he help us now? Could you picture someone saying that? So his father said, he took us out of Mitzrayim for two reasons. We were on the lowest possible level. But there's Chus Avos, and there's also his great Rachamim. So that's always there. And you should say Hallel to Hashem for even the fact that we're here today. So then Hashem came to him and told him the time has come to defeat the Midyanim in the merit of the Hallel, he said. So he gathered an army, and then Hashem said, decrease the number of soldiers. Okay, you remember where we are now? Gidon, okay. And he decreased them. Hashem said, decrease them still more. He decreased them more. Decrease them until they're very few. He decreased them. Why? Because the way to reach the Yeshua that we want, the place of saying Hallel, the place of personal salvation and collective salvation, is when you say, not only are you great, Hashem, but what? I'm small. So that means that when you're trying to get your story to look somewhat different, you're looking at your own capacity to bond to Hashem through Chesed, through Gvur, Tiferet, Netzach, Chod, Yisod, Malchut, you have to believe that you can, but with Hashem's help, not alone. So this is why this period of Sfira has to lead you to Shavuot, so that you could treasure the instruction book, which is Hashem's rule. So what does this have to do with the other story, you may be very reasonably wondering. Okay, so the other story, the theme is you can't run away from the truth. But the fact that you know the truth doesn't mean you should despair. You should believe that you have the capacity to be whoever Hashem wants you to be. So, in a similar vein, did you ask for more in a similar vein? No, but you're getting it anyway. I'm going to just tell you the end of a story. So skipping the whole beginning of the story. Okay, clear? I was in the living room of the late Rachman Strifka Rebbe, and he wasn't home. I got the appointment time wrong. So I was in the living room, and the woman who I brought to speak to him, who had done something very serious, was in the kitchen speaking to the Rebbetzin. So I didn't belong there. I don't have to hear the details of what this woman did that was wrong. So I'm in the living room, and I started looking at the books. And it's very interesting. You know, like there are all sorts of books that are out of print and whatever. So suddenly I hear the Rebbetzin yell, "Close that book!" And I was like, "Oh, God!" So, of course, I closed the book, and I put it, like, neatly back on the shelf. And I said, "I'm so sorry, I really should have asked." And she said, "Not you. I'm talking to her." So we both looked at her, surprises. She keeps on opening the book to the part of the story in which she failed. After you look at it once, after you look at it twice, close the book. Start a new story. Okay, that's all. Okay. Okay. CD's books outside, there's also a new book.